Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Welcome back from another weekend, which held interesting moments for the leading Republican presidential candidates. Mitt Romney offering that his wife had a couple of Cadillacs, and he doesn't follow NASCAR racing, but he has friends who own entire teams. Rick Santorum confirming that listening to President John F. Kennedy deliver his famous separation of church and state speech made Santorum want to throw up, and calling President Obama a snob for wanting to give people the opportunity to go to college. This morning, Mitt Romney spoke at a rally in Rockford, Michigan. At least he didn't mention the height of trees, but he did recall family road trips.
I saw national parks from one end to the other. I remember that wonderful song that brings that to mind. Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountains' majesty across the fruited plain. I love this country. I was around in that car, by the way. It was a Rambler. It was amazing. It made the whole trip.
Okay. And Rick Santorum was the featured speaker at a local Chamber of Commerce breakfast in the Livonia, where he received cheers for not backing away from comments that he made about how Democrats have the separation of church and state all wrong.
I'm for separation of church and state. The state has no business telling what the church to do. That our founders believed in, which is what I just described, has now been turned on its head. And now it's the church, people of faith, who have no right to come to the public square and express their points of view.
Bill Ballinger is editor of the newsletter Inside Michigan Politics. And Bill, it sounds as if both candidates seem to be, you know, drilling deeper into what even their supporters would say are perhaps their weaknesses long run. Your thoughts?
You mean in the sense that Rick Santorum should maybe stay away from that subject?
Well,
is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm just saying that, you know, the speculation has been that the more he drills deep into these conservative issues, the more Mitt Romney talks about driving around in a car, that they seem to be underscoring, you know, their weaknesses in you know, down the road. But how is that resonating in Michigan?
Well, you say down the road, and then you get into the question of a general election versus tomorrow's primary, and that's what it's all about right now. The question is, are they the same thing? They're totally different. Mm-hmm. For instance, how big an issue is the auto bailout really going to be with Republican voters tomorrow in Michigan? I don't think it's going to be that big an issue, because all four Republicans who are still running on the ballot here in Michigan take pretty much the same position. That is, there should not have been a federal bailout of the auto industry. So you get past the primary tomorrow, particularly if, let's say, Mitt Romney is the nominee against Barack Obama and the Democrats, who have already been pounding him that he made the wrong call and he did the wrong thing. And there's evidence that that does resonate with the independents and Democrats who are going to be voting in November, not tomorrow.
Well, what about Rick Santorum's comments? People may disagree with his interpretation, for instance, of President Kennedy's comments. President Kennedy didn't say that people of faith have no right in the public square. He was talking about beliefs and policy, and President Obama didn't say that people who don't go to college are less than people who do. He wants to give opportunities. But how does the race stand? You've been telling us that while, you know, Mitt Romney had a surge over the last week, regaining on Rick Santorum. What are you seeing now?
I think it's too close to call. I think it's a jump ball going into tomorrow. I think you're absolutely right. Mitt Romney seemed to have the momentum at the end of last week. He was ahead in a couple of polls by 6 and 8 points, seemed poised to keep on going and maybe win even by double digits. Now, all of a sudden, his momentum has been arrested, and it's now a poll coming out last night showing Santorum ahead by 2 points, and another one showing it pretty much dead even within the margin of error. So nobody knows right now what's going to happen on Tuesday the 28th.
And we're hearing, just in the few seconds we have, we're hearing about a push maybe through emails to get Democrats out to vote for Rick Santorum. This is an open primary. They can do that. Are you hearing that?
Yes, but also you got to remember that there are other motives for independents and Democrats to vote for other than Santorum. For instance, if you're going to pick the most moderate of the four Republicans, and that's usually a motive for Democrats and independents who want to play in a Republican primary. Mitt Romney is actually the most moderate candidate, so I think he's going to get a certain amount of votes, particularly from independents. And don't forget Ron Paul. Ron Paul has the greatest crossover appeal to independents and Democrats of all four Republicans who are going to be on the ballot, with his libertarian views on foreign policy. And he got huge crowds here in Michigan yesterday and today in Michigan. He's going to get 10 or 15% of the vote, in my opinion. Okay. So he's a factor.
Well, we're not going to forget him either. Bill Ballinger, editor of the newsletter Inside Michigan Politics, will check in with you again. Thank you.
Thank you.
And all the Republican candidates have campaigned on cutting the deficit. So would their tax proposals do that? Well, you've probably heard the headline already. According to a project of the Bipartisan Committee for a Responsible Budget, the federal debt would actually balloon under the plans of all but Ron Paul, who would cut the deficit but also cut entire wings of government. And what about President Obama's plans? Lots of talk about taxing income over $1 million and the so-called Buffett rule. But is it in writing? Our next guest, Howard Gluckman, says the competing thinking on taxes sets the stage for an epic battle. So let's get a primer. Howard Gluckman is resident fellow at the nonpartisan nonprofit Tax Policy Center, also editor of the blog Tax Vox. And Howard, in reading some of your analysis, we see why, for instance, Herman Cain's 999 plan was such a great bumper sticker. It was so simple.
No, absolutely.
But not as much with some of these candidates. So let's start with former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. His has several components, starting with permanently extending the Bush-era tax cuts. Take it from there.
Okay, sure. So actually, all of the Republican candidates would extend the Bush-era tax cuts. That's something that they all have in common. But that's where he'd start. He'd take those tax cuts that are supposed to end at the end of this year, and he'd continue them indefinitely, make them permanent. But then on top of that, he says what he would do is reduce all income tax rates by 20%. The other thing he would do is he would eliminate capital gains taxes, eliminate taxes on dividends and interest for people making less than $200,000. It sounds pretty good, but the truth is that most people making less than $200,000 don't have a lot of income on capital gains and dividends. But it sounds like a pretty good idea if you're trying to appeal to the Republican base. Yeah. Then on the business side, what he'd do is he would reduce the current top rate for corporations, which is now 35%, down to 25%. That's a very dramatic cut, but it's not nearly as dramatic as his Republican challengers who cut even more than that. And then he'd also do things like abolish the estate tax. This, again, is something that all Republican candidates have talked about doing. It benefits overwhelmingly very, very rich families.
Because this estate tax is a tax on inherited estates over $5 million or so.
That's right. That's exactly right. If you left today's law alone, 99% of people would never pay the estate tax.
Well, a couple things. You and others, I'm looking at Lori Montgomery writing in the Washington Post, say that Mitt Romney's plan would cut taxes for a lot of people, but favor the rich. And also, without, you know, any taxes raised and without any revenue stream that we can see in this plan, he would add to the deficit. Address those two criticisms.
You know, it's great when you're running for president or running for any other office to promise that you're going to cut people's taxes. It's great when you promise that you're going to reduce the deficit. When you cut taxes as much as these candidates are proposing to do, it makes it very difficult, probably even impossible, to reduce the deficit. If you look at everything that Mitt Romney is proposing to do, it would add almost $1 trillion, about $900 billion, to the budget deficit in just one year, in 2015. That's a massive cut in tax revenues. Most of that would go to the highest earning households.
Well, and one of the reasons that these households making more than $1 million would get such a break is that they also would be in position to receive the benefit of Mitt Romney's corporate tax reductions.
That's correct. This is a matter of a lot of controversy among economists, but basically that's right. What the Tax Policy Center assumes is that shareholders of companies benefit a lot from corporate tax cuts. You remember Mitt Romney famously saying that corporations are people too. Well, what he meant was that corporations are basically an organization of shareholders, so that when the corporate rate is cut, the people who benefit from that are the people who own the companies, and those are overwhelmingly wealthy people. So this is skewed very much towards what Republican candidates like to call the job creators.
Well, what about closing loopholes? What about, you know, taxing that carried interest that Romney now enjoys? This is money that is paid to equity firm people like Mitt Romney. It's paid from Bain Capital out of other investors' earnings. So even though it looks like a salary to Mitt Romney, he gets to declare it as income from investments, so it's taxed at a lower rate. I'm guessing there's no suggested changes in his plan.
What the Romney economic advisor said last week was that he would make this so that it did not lose revenue. He would find offsetting spending reductions and tax increases so that this would not add to the deficit. But he didn't say how he'd do it. That's the big question. And you talk about carried interest. You know, carried interest is one of these things that's a very high-profile issue. The Democrats will certainly make a big deal out of it. But the truth of the matter is it raises a trivial amount of money when you're talking about trying to make up for $900 billion in tax cuts. And realistically, you've got to start thinking about how you're going to cut tax breaks that benefit middle-income people, such as the mortgage interest deduction.
And is anyone proposing getting rid of some of those deductions for mortgage interest for child? Nobody.
Nope.
Let's move to Rick Santorum and maybe differentiate between his plan and Mitt Romney's. He also cuts taxes for corporations, but he also seems to cut more taxes for the less wealthy, especially families with children.
That's right. Think of Rick Santorum as Mitt Romney on steroids when it comes to taxes. Whatever Romney has proposed, Santorum has proposed to do even more. So what Santorum says is, let's just cut back to two tax brackets. There'd be a 28% tax bracket and a 10% tax bracket. He would lower the top rate for capital gains and dividends for everybody, not just for people making less than $200,000, but for everybody, to 12%. Abolish the estate tax. He would reduce corporate income taxes, basically cut them in half from what they are today, except for manufacturing companies who would pay zero under Santorum's plan. And then the other thing he would do that the other candidates wouldn't do is he would make a group of tax credits that are currently available for low-income families with children. He paints himself as very much the pro-family candidate. So what he would do is he'd triple the tax credit for families, low-income families with children. Rick Santorum's tax plan is even more expensive than Mitt Romney's. It would add a little bit more than $1 trillion to the budget deficit. For middle-income families, people making between $50,000 and $75,000, they would do a little better under Santorum than under Romney.
And would increase the debt by about $4.5
trillion, right.
According to some of the analysis. So what does Rick Santorum's people say about where he would make up for this revenue?
Well, they, again, don't say. They do say that it would happen on the spending side, not on the tax side. He's talked about changing the nature of Medicare. He would take most of the social welfare programs, Medicaid, food stamps, the whole collection of social safety net programs that we know that are currently run by the federal government, he'd turn those all over to the states. But even that doesn't get him even close to what he's talking about doing. So he's talked about having a $5 trillion spending cut, but again doesn't define where he'd get the $5 trillion. Cutting spending by $5 trillion over 5 years is a massive spending reduction. It would fundamentally change the nature of the federal government, what it does. But again, he has not described quite how he'd do it.
Howard Gluckman, resident fellow at the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center. When we come back, Ron Paul, Newt Gingrich, and Barack Obama. Our tax primer continues. Are you taking notes here and now? Welcome back to our primer on the presidential candidate's tax proposals with Howard Gluckman of the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center. And Howard, most of the Republicans talk about tax cuts, but no specific cuts in spending, except for Ron Paul. He's talked about cutting the military budget, eliminating five agencies, including the EPA and the Fed. But what about taxes?
Okay, so Ron Paul, we have not really been able to calculate what Ron Paul wants to do because it's so sweeping, but it's also so vague. Ron Paul has basically said he wants to repeal the income tax. He would get rid of the payroll tax that funds Social Security and Medicare, and he'd replace it with something, but he doesn't really explain what it would be. So in that kind of environment, we really can't calculate what Ron Paul would do. But he would basically keep the current deficit track on track wouldn't change it very much at all when you net out these giant tax cuts with what would be just massive cuts in spending.
Well, and briefly touch on Newt Gingrich. He makes all capital gains, dividends, interest income tax-free, also proposes eliminating all deductions and credits except for the earned income credit, child credit, foreign tax credits, and deductions for mortgage interest and charitable gifts.
So what Newt Gingrich does is something very interesting. It's kind of strange when you think about it, but it's very interesting. What he says is, I am going to give you a choice. You can either pay taxes under the current system, or you can pay taxes under my new system, which would basically be a flat tax of 15%. As you say, he would keep deductions for charitable contributions and mortgage interest deduction, and then there would be, under this flat tax, a big personal deduction of $12,000 per person. And that's because when you have a consumption-like tax, which is really what Gingrich is proposing, is something like a value-added tax, it tends to be very unfair for low-income people. So to make it a little more
like
fair,
a sales tax, and they tend to buy more things.
That's right. They spend more of their income on consumption. They don't save very much.
Right.
So doing all that would add, in 2015, $1.3 trillion to the budget deficit. Now, the thing to remember about this is, you know, normally when the Tax Policy Center does budget analysis of tax plans, it talks about numbers like, you know, $500-600 billion or even $1 trillion over 10 years. We think about that as big tax cuts. What these guys are doing is they're proposing tax cuts that are approaching or exceeding $1 trillion in 1 year. Now, the federal government collects only about $3 trillion. So you're talking about a massive cut in federal revenues.
So those are the Republican candidates campaigning largely on, you know, the oversized deficit, but as you and others are pointing out, their tax plans would raise it even more. What about President Obama? I mean, much had been said about how he wanted to, you know, the Buffett rule, how he wanted to make people of a certain income make sure that they paid a certain percentage, you know, tax people making over $1 million, a higher rate. What does it boil down to in the actual plan?
So there is no plan. This is the interesting. President Obama, another politician, you know, running for office, is also being very vague on these very controversial issues. So the president has been talking a lot about the Buffett rule, talking a lot about how we're going to make sure that millionaires don't pay less tax than their secretaries. But when it came down to it, when the president put out his budget the other day, there's no proposal. So we don't know exactly what it is he would do to make sure that the highest income people paid more tax. We do know that the president has said that he would extend all of the Bush tax cuts except for those for the highest income earners. Basically, he would extend 90% of the Bush tax cuts. He'd also extend, as we've all heard, the payroll tax for another year. So, you know, on the individual side, the president is also talking about relatively generous tax breaks without really talking about where he'd get the money to offset them.
But he also would lower the rates on corporate taxes. He has been a little clearer on the business side. And I just want to ask you about that, Howard, because it sounds as if everyone is agreed in lowering some of the corporate rates. Is that because corporations don't pay them at the higher rate of 35%?
So this is the problem. The statutory rate for companies headquartered in the United States is a maximum rate of 35%. That's one of the highest in the world. But American companies also get to take advantage of all kinds of special tax benefits. And those special deals drive down the actual tax rate those companies pay, cut it probably in half. So what President Obama is proposing to do is to reduce the statutory rate from 35% to 28% and get rid of loopholes to help pay for that. But again, he doesn't really tell us which of these special corporate tax breaks he would get rid of. So he's, again, leaving it to your imagination without getting very specific.
And just generally, when it comes to individuals, I mean, it's pretty clear that the Republicans want to lower taxes. Some will be lowering them more on the wealthy than on all Americans. You pointed out Mitt Romney. And the thinking going into this election was that the Democrats wanted to increase taxes on the rich. If, in fact, that ever comes to fruition in a Democratic plan, how much will that do to cut the deficit?
Well, not very much. The problem is that there are not enough rich people in this country to pay those higher taxes to get the deficit down very much. The reality is, President Obama doesn't want to talk about this, but the reality is that if you're really going to tackle a deficit, you've got to do something on the spending side, and you've got to do something on the tax side. And what you do on the tax side is probably going to require raising taxes, not just for the rich people, but for middle-class people and upper-middle-class people. And it's probably going to mean doing something about the mortgage interest deduction and doing something about the special tax breaks for getting employer-sponsored health insurance, and doing something about all of these special tax breaks that we've come to think of as our birthright in the United States.
But none of this will be part of the discussion until after the election.
I'm afraid you're right. There is, in Maryland, a cat running for the United States Senate. His name is Hank the Cat, and Hank is running on a platform of more milk in everybody's food bowl. And
are you serious?
I'm serious. I think Hank is serious, too. That's kind of the metaphor here. That's how all these presidential candidates are running. They're also running, you know, on a platform of more milk in the food bowl, but they don't want to say how they're going to pay for it.
That's Howard Gluckman, resident fellow at the nonpartisan nonprofit Tax Policy Center, also editor of the blog Tax Box, with our primer on the tax plans of the presidential candidates. Howard, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
So that was a lot of numbers. So we'll post Howard's writing at hereandnow.org. And meanwhile, while there, what do you think? Do you believe that cutting taxes will boost job creation? Are you disappointed that President Obama isn't standing behind some of his tax increase proposals, at least not yet? Would you vote for a cat? Hereandnow.org. Love to hear from you. Latest news is next. Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Two senior Afghan national security officials were due to visit Washington this week, but that trip has been canceled because of the spasm of violence launched by last week's unintentional burning of Korans by U.S. troops. The latest attack, a suicide bombing today at the airport in Jalalabad that killed at least nine. There have been more than two dozen deaths in the last 5 days. The U.S. and NATO have apologized for the Koran burning, which they said happened when a prison library was emptied of books that were carrying coded messages. But the Taliban is claiming responsibility for some of the violence. The BBC's Bilal Sarwari joins us from Kabul. And Bilal, first of all, we understand that in this suicide bombing today, it was Afghans that were killed, not U.S. forces. So how can the Taliban claim this is retribution for something U.S. troops did?
This is exactly what the Afghan officials are saying, that six of those killed were civilians. But Afghan officials are also saying, let's not jump into any conclusions. In the last 1 week alone, 30 Afghans have been killed and more than 100 have been injured. They say it's been as painful for us as it has been for NATO forces. The worst thing is, as one general told me, that the public hatred is towards the Afghan National Security Forces as much as it is towards the U.S. soldiers and NATO soldiers at this stage.
Well, and what does this do to the plan to turn over the security of the country from U.S. forces to these Afghan forces? The transition was supposed to take place in 2014. Is there a sense that it might happen sooner or even later because of this spasm of violence?
The Afghan officials are hoping that the Afghans and the international forces will simply not allow the Taliban to get what they've always wanted. They want an immediate withdrawal of the foreign forces and a weak Afghan government that is simply not going to be able to cope with the insurgency as it is right now. So they're hoping they can start rebuilding the relationship, which has been extremely difficult, at least in the last week. And I was speaking to several Afghan generals this morning. They said that operations have been affected, and any early NATO withdrawal will be extremely damaging and difficult for the Afghan National Security Forces to handle.
Well, I just want to underscore something you just said. You said you talked to Afghan officials who said that operations have already been affected, and we know that after the two American advisors were literally assassinated, shot in the head on Saturday in the Interior Ministry building, the U.S., France, and Germany pulled civilian staff from Afghan government buildings. You know, the Interior Ministry was considered one of the most heavily guarded buildings in Kabul, and the Taliban is saying they were able to get someone in there. Whether it was the Taliban, whether it was a disaffected assassin, either way, it isn't very secure. What are people saying to you today about the feeling there in Kabul?
Well, the feeling is one of deep disappointment. I've been speaking to several Afghan generals, and they say that the withdrawal of foreign advisors, NATO advisors, already have had a very big impact on the operational sides of things. So, for example, you cannot call an airstrike. For example, you cannot call a drone for surveillance. You have to remember the Afghan National Security Forces are still in their very infant stages. And the very fact that these Afghan generals would not have their advisors mean that it would also have a huge impact on training.
What about talks with the Taliban? There have been reports a couple of weeks ago that talks were underway among Afghan and U.S. and Taliban leaders. But President Karzai leaked that information. Some said that was because he wasn't, you know, happy with the talks. There are people who would like to see the talks, people who wouldn't like to see the talks. So where does this spasm of violence fit into that?
The Taliban, who have entered some sorts of talks, will have to appeal to their own constituencies, especially to the young commanders, the fighting force, that, look, we're not giving in to America. And they have done exactly that. They have condemned the latest incidents. The challenge for the Afghan government and the challenge for the United States government has so far been that they have failed to come with one united voice. Let's put an end to the violence. And, you know, President Karzai has been criticized for interfering very late. There's also reason for that, because Karzai can't be seen during President Obama's bed. And it's such a sensitive subject. Quran is the holy book. Islam is the sacred religion here.
That's the BBC's Bilal Sarwari in Kabul, Afghanistan. Bilal, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
And, of course, we'll continue to follow that story. But up next, how to keep older workers going. That's in 30 seconds here and now. Welcome back. The Bureau of Labor Statistics projects that by 2018, about a quarter of the labor force will be 55 or older. Many companies are happy with that. They don't want to spend money training younger workers. But how to keep the older ones going? Duke Energy, based in Charlotte, North Carolina, has one answer.
My wrist extender, left hand. One, two, three, four.
Every morning, line technicians at Duke's Little Rock Operations Center in Charlotte, North Carolina, do stretching exercises. Harley Davidson has a similar program. They also have trainers handing out ice packs to workers as they come off the line. Let's learn more about Duke's program with Jim Stanley, Senior Vice President for Power Delivery. Jim, welcome.
Thank you very much.
We also have 53-year-old Barry Poe with us. He's worked for Duke for 34 years. Barry, welcome to you as well.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. And you are a lineman, correct?
That's correct.
Which means that you go out and repair power lines when there's storm damage. How physical is it? How, you know, where do you feel it?
Basically, all over. I mean, our job is very strenuous. We basically use every muscle of our body. I mean, we push, pull, lift. That's just the nature of our job.
Yeah. And what about the exercise that you do in the morning? Can you just describe a little of it, and how does it help you?
7:30 every morning, we do a regimen of exercises or stretches, and it's about six or seven different stretches, and each stretch takes about 30 to 45 seconds, and they're just designed to help us do our daily activities.
Right. Would you do this by yourself, you know, if you were at home, or would you join a gym or something to do it for yourself?
Well, I actually catch myself doing it at home.
Now you do.
When I do different things, yes, I do, because, you know, being 53, going on 54, things just don't work like they used to. And I didn't used to do stretches. And then when the company started doing it, there was something to it, and it started making you feel a little bit better. So it became a habit.
Yeah. Well, Jim Stanley, we understand that when the class was set up, there was just one request, no leotards, which
that's,
I love.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's accurate.
But why did you start?
Well, it takes probably 4 to 6 years to technically train a line technician, and then another couple of years to get them the experience required to be a what I'll call a fully developed line technician. And we want folks like Barry to be working for us and have a career as extended as he wants it to be.
Yeah, and this is sort of counterintuitive for a lot of people. A lot of people think that older workers are getting pushed out. You're saying there's a cost-benefit equation to keeping them. But I'm wondering, too, to keeping them in shape, the idea of having them not just work longer but be healthier while they do, where does it hit the bottom line? Do you save money because of that?
Well, like Barry said, we have a very strenuous job in front of our line techs. They're out in all sorts of weather doing all sorts of work. And we were noticing that we had a lot of strains and muscle pulls And we wanted to find a program that would help us alleviate that for the technician's sake.
Mm-hmm.
So we looked outside and developed a program along with an outside company. And we hope this not only helps them on a daily basis, but also puts in their mind that whenever they do a piece of work, it's a good idea to get your body ready.
Yeah, well, and we understand that the exercises are customized for the different jobs. So someone who works on overhead lines might have a different stretch from someone else?
Yeah, we have actually, when they came to design the exercises, they actually looked at every specific job that we do. If we climb a pole, we have exercises designed for that. If we do underground, we have exercises designed for that. And we have magnetic placards on the inside doors of our trucks that we can look at those, and whatever job that we're going to do, we can do that before we do the assignment.
Huh. Well, research shows that private sector injuries have dropped, sprains and strains, and the thinking is that it could be because of programs like this. And Jim, I just have to point out Duke Energy, one of the biggest energy companies in the country. You're familiar with what happens when workers aren't taken care of. We mentioned in passing that Duke hires contractors, and Duke took a lot of heat from unions because of one contractor, Sunlin, which was accused of not taking care of its workers, a lot of worker safety violations. You don't have to comment on that, but this is certainly better PR, but also better for the bottom line. I mean, are you having fewer insurance payouts, fewer workmen's compensation claims?
We are, Robin. We just completed the second best safety year we've ever had as a power delivery unit. So the types of things we've implemented, including stretching, are paying off. And, of course, that does pay off in terms of workmen's comp claims as well, and those have been reduced over the years.
So woohoo, Barry, you're headed for like some sort of perfect record safety year.
We're doing better.
Well, Barry, I'm wondering, I mean, it's nice to get the safety records, but you're 53 years old. How much does this mean for you to be able to continue? I have to say, I have a picture tacked up at my desk. It's a favorite. It's the obituary of the photographer who took the picture, Rocco Morbido, and it's a linesman, you know, strapped to a pole, giving the breath of life to another linesman who was electrocuted. It's, I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's incredible. You know, the work that you do is pretty important. How important is it to you to keep doing it?
Well, you know, when I signed on to do this 34 years ago, it's something that I enjoy doing. And I have to take care of myself. And Duke has designed a program, not only the stretching program, but we've also become an more ergonomic company, and the tools that they are giving us these days that we don't have to use all the muscles that we used to.
Tell us about what's different in that arena.
Now we have battery-operated cutters where we used to have to use just raw muscle. We have some of the crimpers that we use. We have either hydraulic or battery-operated crimpers. So all of these things combined, they make my muscles last longer.
Actually, you've touched on something. I mean, we're reading about the University of Michigan Center for Ergonomics trying to find out ways for surgeons to do their work without having to bend and twist so much because they're having so many injuries there. We're reading about a mining company in Tennessee that used to require that a worker carry 40-pound buckets of silicate, and now they're having that done with a pump. And on every level, people are saying it's because they want to find ways to keep workers longer because they've invested in them. How long do you want to work?
Well, that's, you know, I don't really know how long I really want to work. You know, that depends on, you know, financial and everything else and grandbabies, you know. Mm-hmm. That's hard to say. But we have guys working in our areas that's 65 years old that still do the same thing that I do. Physically, right now, I'm in pretty good shape. So I can see myself, you know, possibly work until I'm in my 60s.
And Robin, we would welcome Barry staying with us as long as he wants to.
I guess so. Jim Stanley, Senior Vice President of Power Delivery for Duke Energy. Barry Poe, a line technician for 34 years. Talking about the company's programs to keep older workers healthier as they stay on the job. Thank you both so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
I am a lineman for the county.
I just had to. But it also helps us alert you that we have a rare interview with Glenn Campbell for you. He's on his farewell tour confronting Alzheimer's. No company plan can help that. That's later this week on Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. I once had a job that was more fun than any should have been. As correspondent for the Today Show, I got to travel the country, meeting people like Bill Rausch. Bill was co-founder of the Cornerstone Theater Company, a bunch of 20-something Harvard grads who decided to take theater to the people. We covered their production of Tartuffe in tiny Norcator, Kansas, population 100 plus or so. The wide main street was filled with shuttered businesses. The title character, Tartuffe, was recast as a farmer. Bill Rausch has now settled down in Ashland, Oregon, where he's artistic director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. But he's still looking for ways to bring new people to theater. This year, he'll be presenting The Merry Wives of Windsor, Iowa, complete with presidential candidates and a state fair. Although Romeo and Juliet will play pretty straight.
Come, gentle knight. Come, loving, black-browed knight. Give me my Romeo.
The Oregon Shakespeare Festival began its 77th season this past weekend with Romeo and Juliet, the musical comedy Animal Crackers, and a world premiere of The White Snake. And Bill Rausch joins us from Jefferson Public Radio in Ashland with more. Hello again.
It's such a joy to hear your voice, Robin.
Do you remember your production of Tartuffe in Norcator, Kansas?
I remember it vividly.
Well, it was 1986, and I say this with the greatest admiration for the people of this a little bit of a foundering farm town. And here comes this, you know, this kid from Harvard. And I remember they came for the auditions. Tartuffe, Tartuffe, Tartuffe. You know, some of the people had not. I'm not a Molière expert either, but they jumped in. What did that tell you? People jumping into Molière.
Everywhere the Cornerstone worked, no matter how small the community, people came out of the woodwork to get involved. It was incredibly inspiring.
What sparked this idea?
Well, while in school, we had heard a very upsetting statistic that only 2% of the American people went to professional theater on anything approaching a regular basis. And so we decided we wanted to go out and meet the other 98% and make plays with them and for them.
What were some of the other plays? We mentioned Tartuffe in Norcator, Kansas. What else?
We did a biracial Romeo and Juliet with African-Americans and European-Americans in a small town in Mississippi. We did an adaptation of Peer Gynt by Ibsen in a fishing community in eastern Maine. We worked on a Native American reservation in Nevada where we did the Greek tragic trilogy, the Oresteia. It was remarkable because people always brought their life experiences to bear on the work and made much deeper connections with the material than anything that we would have done on our own as a group of professional artists.
Yeah.
The Tartuffe that you were around for, our original plan was to do it about televangelism because that was the height of some of the televangelist scandals. And in the end, it became instead about the disintegration of the family farm. And the connection with the community and the connection with Molière's play was much deeper and much more interesting.
Well, so fast forward through the years, here you are at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, made up of a lot of longtime theatergoers who have memorized the casts. They have a sense of ownership about the festival. What happens when you approach a work and say, you know what, I'm seeing this differently. I'm going to cast, as we read you did a couple years ago, Our Town with an Indian-born actress in the role of Emily Webb. I'm going to cast an African-American as Marion the Librarian in The Music Man. You know, knowing full well that the chances of there being an African-American librarian in what, you know, the early 1900s was just, it wouldn't have happened.
Well, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? When does a work of art become enough part of the classical canon that it makes sense to re-explore it? And, you know, that Music Man, we very deliberately, and with Our Town, we were saying these are American classics, and they should stand right alongside our productions of Shakespeare as plays that are explored with an acting company that reflects the full diversity of our nation. And it's not a problem, it's an opportunity to have a dialogue between the world we live in now and the worlds in which these different works of art were created.
Well, let's take a look at what you're planning for this season. I mentioned The Merry Wives of Windsor, Iowa.
You know what, Robin? That is written by Allison Carey, who co-founded Cornerstone, who you met
Yes.
all those years ago. Allison has become a real expert in blending contemporary American jargon with Shakespeare's own language.
So Shakespearean characters will go to Iowa and failed presidential candidates make appearances.
That is correct. Falstaff is a failed presidential candidate who ran out of funds, so he's stuck in this little town in Iowa. There's gay marriage, and there's the Iowa State Fair. There's a giant butter cow. What's not to love, Robin?
Not to love. We also understand this year you're bringing back a work that you first created as a college student, Medea. Now, people get upset when I say the Scottish play, but your title is Medea, the Scottish play, Cinderella.
I think you can say Macbeth. We're not
I'm not on
the
stage. I know.
You're not on a stage.
But someone somewhere might be.
Yes, okay.
Can break
and
their lips.
They have to plug their ears.
So Medea, Macbeth, Cinderella, a mashup and a lifelong passion for you. Why?
This started when I was in college. I heard a reference to the three great populist movements in Western drama, being Greek tragedy, Elizabethan drama, and the American musical. And I was really interested, even at that young age, in what creates a work of art that speaks to and appeals to a broad section of society. So I thought, what if we take an example of each of these three and we lay them side by side, and what might we learn? And the synchronicity between the shared rhythms. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a signature moment.
Yeah.
Medea is talking to the women of the chorus about how to take revenge on her husband. And she says, shall I set their house of honeymoon on fire, or shall I plunge into the nuptial bower and plunge a sharp knife through their vitals? She pulls out that knife as she's imagining this. And, of course, Macbeth says, is this a dagger which I see before me? and it rolls on from there.
What does Cinderella do?
Cinderella sings about her sister's sour green apple envy. And the reason she comes up with that image is she is paring a green apple with a paring knife, and that also becomes a blade that Macbeth sees. So it's about constantly finding playful, funny, haunting, mysterious, provocative connections between the plays.
Well, that's still ahead. And closer, The White Snake. This is based on a Chinese fable. Let's listen to a little of the music.
It's the story of a snake spirit who becomes so enlightened that she puts herself into the body of a woman and falls in love with a man, but he doesn't know that she's actually a snake. It's just a beautiful, beautiful, moving tale of forbidden love.
That's Oregon Shakespeare Festival Artistic Director Bill Rausch. If people in Norcator, Kansas have been wondering, whatever happened to that kid who talked us into putting on a production of Tartuffe? There he is.
I don't know if you know how important Norcator became to us. We ended up calling it our rural headquarters, and we went back there several times. And when we did a national tour with a couple people from every town we had worked in 1991, we all pulled together in Norcator and rehearsed there and launched the national tour from that town.
Wonderful. So this is a mission that sort of started in your, 20s. To sort of make sure theater went beyond the 2% that you'd heard went to see theater regularly. Do you think you're achieving that mission still?
Absolutely. I know that I'm still deeply on track in terms of my life mission, and I feel very, very lucky.
Bill, thanks so much. So nice to speak with you.
Robin, it's wonderful to talk to you.
And this is Shishir Kurup's music from Medea, Macbeth, Cinderella. I'm sorry, you're not supposed to say it. Someone will break a leg. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us to see what the week brings here and now.
Come earth, come fire, come waters of flood, and spire restrain this woman whose blood.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.